care. 288-4128. The Whole Health Center is a nonprofit organization.
Good morning and welcome to Alternative Currents. I'm Bella Johnson. The Forgiving Self, The Road from Resentment to Connection by PhD psychologist Robert Caron is the subject of today's show. From the book jacket, can we be forgiven our insensitivity and betrayals? Should we always forgive those who have hurt us? What enables us to reopen our hearts when we do? Interweaving themes from literature, movies, current events, and from his practice as a clinical psychologist, Robert Caron addresses the difficult questions at the heart of many human dramas, highlighting the struggle between our wish to repair our relationships on the one side and our tendency to see ourselves as victims who need revenge on the other. Given the nature of the events of September 11th, I thought this an appropriate symbolic topic for today's show and hope you find it informative and enjoyable on a personal level, this personal level certainly being the intention of the author. Perhaps our dialogue today will spark some deeper thought on the repair of our humanity as we continue being challenged to reach more humane solutions for our world in days to come. Robert Caron has a private practice in New York City and is associate clinical professor at the Derner Institute. He is the father of a 9-year-old boy, and The Forgiving Self is his fourth book. Welcome to Alternative Currents, Dr. Caron.
Thank you.
Can you tell us first how you came to write this book on the topic of forgiveness?
I wrote it because a number of years ago, an editor asked me to write an article on forgiveness, and I had never given the subject much thought. But I thought, well, I could probably do it. I'll get into it. But it didn't strike me as a very interesting topic until I started writing about it. It was only then that I realized that this topic, which I thought was square and sappy and old-fashioned and more sort of related to religion and not psychology, was really as important as and dynamic an issue as I could find in all of psychology, and that indeed much of our psychological, almost all that's important that happens internally and between people relates to forgiveness in some way.
Yeah, I noticed in your book you gave a personal example of your journey with your father as he was dying and the bridge between him and your son. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, my dad and I had a very difficult relationship, and he was always a kind of shut down, somewhat embittered man who also had a warmth and tenderness inside of him that he had a hard time living through. In the book, I talk about these two different selves. Really, there's any number of selves that can dwell within us, but for the purpose of this subject, we can think of ourselves as having a forgiving self, which is loving and lovable, that can tolerate hurts from others and still recognize that there's a bond. And then there's the insecure, self-doubting, self-hating, grudgeful self that leans towards resentment and bitterness and always feels like a victim. And my dad, I think, much of his life tended to live through that second self, as I think we all do to some extent. And it was only when he was dying that I realized the degree to which I had been not only resentful about his treatment of me and his criticalness and his lack of warmth in many occasions, but also that I loved him tremendously and that was constantly seeking after his love, almost the way a little boy would. And this recognition, coupled with some very moving things that happened between me and him, including my asking him at the time that he was close to death, to tell me that he loved me, which he did with a tremendous warmth, a surprising degree of clarity and warmth, and also added that he loved my son, which meant a lot to me because I know they had a special relationship. All of this helped me to really grow up somewhat, not only in terms of my relationship with my dad, but my relationship with myself, and to recognize myself all that more clearly as a loving person.
Why do you think it's so hard to ask for what we need from other people? Because as you mentioned in the book, you did ask, and he gave you that. Why do we hold back from asking for what we need?
Well, there's a number of reasons, and it differs somewhat from person to person, but I think all these reasons come into play with us. For one thing, we don't want to ask. We don't ask because we don't know what we want. When we're caught up in resentment and bitterness, we don't know that we're wounded in love. What we know is that, you know, that person's no good. We feel contempt. We feel hateful. We claim we don't care about the person. We couldn't care less if he was in our lives. We just don't realize what we want. I have a friend who said to me at one point during the writing of this book, you know, Bob, I just don't get it. People who don't forgive, they hold grudges for decades. You know, the Balkans with all this tribal, you know, warfare that goes on and on for generations. You know, what is that all about? I just don't understand. And I said to him, well, you know, you should understand. You haven't spoken to your father in 15 years. And he said, that's different, Bob. He's a monster. And I think this is the place we can easily go with the people who've wounded us. And so we don't even know what we want from them. It would be the furthest thing from this man's mind that what he really wanted from his father, that there was something crying in him to get this from his father, was for his father to really acknowledge the hurts he'd caused and the sorrow he felt about him and the fact that he did love his son. So that's one thing. And another thing is we have a lot of pride. And we, when we get into this unforgiving self of ours, we'd rather in some ways go down with our bitterness than reach out and try to repair.
So when is it important to make that face-to-face physical reparation, and when would it be more prudent to forgive something within oneself because there's just no way that there's going to be that communication that's reached with another person, so one is putting themselves in a position where it would be disrespectful to keep that encounter going?
You mean disrespectful of oneself?
Yes. In other words, with an abusive parent, for example, this man who said his father was a monster, if reparations were made, I'd take my hat off to him, but I've seen situations where it just seems like flying in the face of more abuse to keep encountering someone who just can't get beyond that.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's different ways of protecting oneself. I think the way in which he was protecting himself was to deny that he cared. And I think that we hurt ourselves when we do that. I was seeing a man just the other day in my practice, who had stopped talking to his mother when he was very young because of her. She had an abusive streak in her. She isn't what we tend to think of as the abusive parent who hits a child, but she had a truly abusive streak in her in terms of how she dealt with him. And at a certain point in his very little young life, he shut himself off from her. And when I first met him, not too long ago, he told me he just didn't have any feelings for her. And yet the other day when we were talking about he was starting to remember experiences he'd had with her, and he was welling up with tears. And one of the experiences he remembered was that she became more interested in him. He began performing better in school. And he was very choked up about it. And I asked him what that was about. And he said, because she was getting interested in me for all the wrong reasons. And I understood what he meant by that. But I also recognized something which he hadn't yet recognized, which is that those tears were tears of love. You don't cry about not being seen by somebody and not being cared about by somebody who you don't love. And he, and I think it's a tremendously valuable thing to recognize that we do have this love for people, especially parents, you know, people that we, you know, that are very close to us, even those who've hurt us and who in some way we can't tolerate living with. So I think that for all of us, it's very valuable to know our love is there, even if in some way we're angry at the other person, or we don't know how to deal with the other person, or we feel that dealing with the other person is dangerous. And whether or not it makes sense to try to work something out with that person, well, I think unless it's an act of masochism, like going back eternally, you know, pleading with mom, show me your love, as if mom is the only person on earth who can give you love, unless it's a case like that where you're really kind of enmeshed, I think it's always worth making the effort to see what you can get, what's possible. You know, and the guy I was talking about earlier who hadn't spoken to his father in 15 years, his father really wanted contact with him. Now, it's true, his father was an SOB, but his father loved him. And I think whatever he could have with his father would be valuable.
Yeah, you say, you know, to continue going back and trying to repair these things, and it's funny, I don't normally watch a lot of television, but I happen to have caught a special a couple of nights ago on Steve McQueen, very much in my generation and very much one of those charismatic figures. And it's interesting, it just seemed like he kept going back to make this kind of connection with his mother, who kept rejecting him. And then he turns around with the three women, the three wives that he was with, ultimately destroying relationships and himself, looking for that complete forgiving mother. Now, I realize, you know, there wasn't the information back in those times that there is now to do that kind of healing work. But nevertheless, it seems like that's a common theme, that we continue carrying those parental relationships on in our current relationships with partners, really unconsciously often at times.
You bet. I think it's a very important point you're raising. You know, a lot of what we think of as trying to repair is really an aspect of feeling, it's not really coming from the strong side of us. It's coming from a kind of defeated place where we feel that only if the other person will embrace us, only then can we become whole. And only then can we, you know, attain our true stature. And until then, we're just like, emotionally crippled. And I think this is a phenomenon that should not be confused with seeking forgiveness.
So in that case, some inner child work might be in order.
Well,
I mean, he did go to a psychiatrist. He and his first wife did go. Fairly amazed that they got so little out of it, or that he seemed to have gotten so little insight out of it. But I guess a person can only receive what they can receive.
Well, also, you know, you just don't know what the psychiatrist was up to.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, sometimes you might go to therapy and just not get what you need because of the therapist. I mean, it could be either way.
Yeah.
It could be the patient not being receptive. It could be the therapist not knowing what he's doing. It could be lots of reasons why it doesn't work, or it may not have been enough time.
Right. You say significant acts of forgiveness entail letting go of a precious story we tell about ourselves. To what degree do we hold on to resentment to keep that human drama going?
Oh, I think that is such a powerful force in our lives. I see it everywhere, where we want to have a kind of positive view of ourselves and a kind of sanitized view of ourselves, where we have the moral high ground and the other person is the bad guy. And you show me any grudge state where a person says, you know, I hate that person and we'll never talk to him again, and, you know, he really screwed me. In 99% of them, you'll see somebody who is holding on as tight as he can to a story about himself that sort of vindicates him and leaves him clean and free. We don't like to look back on situations where things have gone wrong for us and there have been horrible conflicts with others, and recognize that we may have played a part. You know, we're afraid that it not only will it absolve the other person of whatever crimes he committed, but it will also just turn us into the bad guy, and suddenly we'll it's almost as if someone has to be black and someone has to be white. Someone has to be all bad and someone has to be all good. And I talk about it a lot in the book in terms of a black and white view of the universe, where it's something that exists in all of us. It's very primitive. It's the way infants look at the world, and it's something none of us ever quite get out of. But it's certainly a hallmark of maturity and of mature development when we can see the world in shades of gray and recognize that no one is perfect and no one is ever entirely awful, that there's something good and something bad in everybody.
So why are we so afraid of taking responsibility, in your opinion?
Well, it varies an awful lot, the reasons we have for avoiding it, but certainly one of them is we don't want to disturb the story we tell ourselves about ourselves. If we were to take responsibility and acknowledge our own participation in things that go wrong in our lives, then we'd have to look at things a lot differently. We'd have to, we wouldn't have as easy time of it, dividing the world up into good and bad, with ourselves always in that kind of pure, if nevertheless victimized, position.
Now, see, I can't help drawing the parallel between what you're saying and what's happening right now.
Go ahead.
Due to the events of the 11th.
Yeah, let's hear about that.
Because collectively, it's the same kind of thing, as long as we can be the good guys and someone else can be the bad guys.
Oh, in wartime, it's really this kind of splitting of the world into black and white, I think, is an essential thing. It's not the way you want to live in times of peace, and it's certainly not the most mature view of the world. But when you're in battle, and it's your life versus someone else's life, you have no choice but to think of the world that way. Now, it doesn't mean that our forgiving self can't play a part in these times. I think it can, and I think it has a very important part to play. For instance, it can limit the extent of the blackness. We can limit it to those people who are involved in terrorist planning or terrorist acts, and be very careful not to let it spread, let's say, to all of the Islamic world, all of the Arab world, to governments that don't necessarily support terrorism. We have to be very careful not to let it spread too far. So even while this black and white view is critical, who's going to think about Osama bin Laden in this day and age and try to understand and forgive? It's out of the question. The guy can only be perceived as a monster for this type of crime, assuming that he's the one who committed it. But we don't have to, therefore, blacken a whole society. Another thing that we can do, another way in which the forgiving self can come into play in these horrible difficulties, as we struggle for to find a solution, both military and diplomatic, is to make some effort to understand why a significant part of the world hates us and would want to do us ill. If we just take the rigid position of America is beautiful and good, and those who hate us are bad and ugly, we're not going to learn something really important that could help us have a better and more peaceful world, and a richer national life as well. There's nothing. It's very rare for a nation to do this, to try to have this understanding, although I think there are lots of elements in our nation that are trying to have it, to understand what could cause people to feel this way. It doesn't mean we have to hate ourselves or paint ourselves into a corner as being evil, but just, no society is purely good. So how have we been insensitive? How have we been harmful, hurtful? If we can include some of that in the mix, that can be very valuable too. But to think that we can get away from a black and white view and that we could sort of be understanding about terrorists, no, I don't think that's an option.
Right. So we can extrapolate that into or from either way. The parent that's the tyrant, the abusing parent, and how do we go back and make those reparations with that kind of parent, in that we're never separate from that family, no matter how a person might try. So, again, I have to kind of try to bring you back to that and say, what does a person do to heal that kind of primal wound with a parent that just seems to continually reject. I mean, I know in your book you're giving examples of the full circle coming around, and it's very inspirational, and yet still there are people out there that just cannot seem to. I had a client just yesterday, this is why I'm kind of beating this one to death, because she, no matter how she tries, she just cannot get her family to respond. In fact, they just, their response is silence. I mean, what do you do in this case? Where it seems to be beyond that. How does a person start making that repair and forgiving themselves, if anything, for being such a bad person that the family can't accept them?
That's an important way of phrasing it. You know, there is a lot of self-forgiveness work that needs to go on here. And you can't be dependent on others to do it for you. You know, if you have a mother who's, let's say, who's like essentially narcissistic, who only thinks about herself and her own needs, and views everything in the world from that point of view. If you criticize her, she doesn't try to understand where you're coming from or why you're hurt. All she knows is that she's been criticized and that's intolerable. And she leaps down your throat with defensiveness and argument. If you're dealing with someone like that, you really can't be dependent on her to fix your sense of yourself. That's a work that has to go on separately. And as long as you are caught up and needing to get it from her, as if, and by the way, this, you see this all the time if you're a psychologist, you see people going back again and again to a parent trying to get that love and that approval and that acceptance. Well, I talk about myself doing it with my dad, although you see it in more extreme form, where people can't even move on with their lives or move on with their sense of self at all until they get that approval from the parent. And it's and again, I want to really make a powerful distinction between seeking that and being dependent on that and the work of repair and forgiveness that can go on in the context of that sort of relationship. That is not repair work. That is dependency. That is the inability to separate from a parent and grow up. It usually implies an inability to take love elsewhere, because if you could take love elsewhere, that love would help, would begin to heal you and make you feel like you're okay. But what happens is very often is we get stuck having to get it from the parent. And this is not about forgiveness. This is about not growing up.
Well, you mentioned, again in the book, and for listeners, we are speaking to Robert Caron, PhD, author of The Forgiving Self, The Road from Resentment to Connection, published by Doubleday. You mentioned about a parent needing to absorb both the positive as well as the negative emotions of the child and how important that is to the overall health of the child. Can you comment on that?
Well, children all naturally are prepared to express a full range of emotions. We adore their joy, their lovingness, their clownishness, their delight that they take in all things around them, and especially the delight they take in us and our interactions with them. But children also get upset, they get angry, they hate, they become greedy, they become, you know, infuriated, they become inconsolable, and all these are natural human reactions that need to be accepted by a parent and understood. A child's anger, for instance, is can be seen by the parent as the beginnings of a healthy self-assertion and can be really appreciated and enjoyed. You know, it's possible to really enjoy your child's aggression and see it develop and see it, and enjoy even when he's being aggressive toward you, and you can maybe even be aggressive back with him and play with him around it. But if you feel rejected, and if rejection is intolerable because you haven't in some way grown up in that area psychologically, then you're not going to be able to handle your child's aggression. You're not going to be able to handle your child's saying, you know, Mommy, you hurt me, or Daddy, I hate you. And you're going to try to put a lid on it. You're going to be cold or punishing or, you know, wash the kid's mouth out with soap or any number of other horrible things that parents do when they can't tolerate a child's self-expression. And what I see in this is not just healthy development versus unhealthy development, but also a very clear beginning of forgiveness versus grudgingness. Because the more we can accept our own anger, and the better we are at expressing it, the less likely we are to get into a grudge, the more we're able to protest our hurts and dislikes, and not feel at the same time like wounded victims. And on the other side of the equation, the better we are able to hear anger and disapproval and rejection and criticism without going to a horrible place because our parents punished us for going there, and without losing a sense that, yeah, you know, this person is really angry, this person I like is really angry at me right now, but I know there's something that connects us and that will tomorrow will be better than today.
So what degree do you think that these kinds of issues come up culturally or societally in the open society that we've kind of created without the kind of rigid, not that individuals don't have rigid rules, but that we've been trying to be a more compassionate and more understanding society in general with our children?
Well, you know, it's hard to say, because I think that in some respects there is a layer of society in which children are getting more understanding and better treatment than they ever have in the past. There are probably children being raised today who get a level of care and emotional sensitivity, which may have been practically unknown, and maybe any time in history. And yet I think for most kids nowadays, the way society is structured with parents, both parents having to work, with kids being pushed into daycare at earlier and earlier ages, where there's just not a lot of time to tolerate the fact that children are inefficient and messy, and they get in the way, and they don't make our schedules easy because they're not little soldiers the way we have allowed ourselves to become. As a result, for a lot of children today is a very difficult time. And I think that we don't have the tolerance and the patience for the broad range of what it means to be a child emotionally that a more easygoing society could allow.
I think it's time to take a little break and give you a chance to catch your breath. And we'll be back after the station ID. You're listening to WERU-FM, Blue Hill 89.9 and 102.9, Bangor. The show is Alternative Currents, and we're speaking with Robert Caron, Ph.D., author of The Forgiving Self. Be back in a few.
Yeah.
back. For those of you who can't tell from the pops and the cracks, that's some old Bonnie Raitt. And this is Bella Johnson, Alternative Current, speaking today with Robert Caron, PhD, author of The Forgiving Self, The Road from Resentment to Connection, published by Doubleday. I want to let you listeners know that you're free to call into the show and ask Dr. Caron questions. The number here, 469-0500, or toll-free 866-625-WERU. Please do call. Feel welcome to call and make your comments known. Otherwise, we will get on with our dialogue. But do let us hear from you if you want to do that. I'm looking at the chapter, The More We Blame, The Further We Get From Ourselves. And I just want to read a little piece of this here. If there can be no mercy, no leniency, no understanding, no forgiveness, no simple tolerance for the magnificent complexity of being human, if we face every flaw or disliked quality as evidence that our blackened souls require rejection and banishment, we will not be captured by our own awareness and motivated to change. Can you just extend that a little bit and talk in general about this, the blaming?
Yeah, I think the part of the tendency to blame is it goes along with several things. One of them is related to the paragraph you just read, which is that blaming really doesn't allow for the wonderful diversity of who we are. You know, when we blame ourselves and we can't tolerate flaws in ourselves, it's a way of really narrowing what's allowable in a human being down to a very paltry little zone of goodness that's, you know, certified and sanctified and sanitized and everyone would accept, when in reality people are very complex, that we have things that would be considered good, bad, and all kinds of things in between. And in many cases, goodness and badness is not even the issue. You know, it might be more about, you know, the capacity to express our aggression, the capacity to really be in touch with our desires, the fact that sometimes when we really are in touch with what we want and who we are, we're not all that aware or sensitive to someone else's feelings or issues. You know, that there are ways in which we can ignore things that, and as a result, hurt people. But it doesn't make us horrible. It doesn't make us bad. It doesn't make us necessarily unable to really appreciate the goodness of what we are. That's one aspect of blame, is the way it narrows the range of what's possible in humanity. But another important fact about blame, I think, is that blame is one of the tools we use to keep from mourning. And by mourning, I don't mean simply dealing with the death of someone we love, although that's part of it. By mourning, I mean the capacity to really feel our own sadness, to allow ourselves to have our sadness, to experience it, to feel it fully, to express it if we need to share it with another person, to really taste it all the way and in the end be done with it and move on. This could be something that takes a minute or two if it's something small, or it could take a week or a month depending on, you know, how big the loss is. But when no one wants to feel the sadness, everyone wants to get away from it if they can. We all engage in what I call the flight from mourning. And one of the tools we have to evade our own sadness is to blame. You know, this bad thing happened. Let's look for someone to blame. Let's find, you know, it was your fault. If it hadn't been for you, you know, our date wouldn't have gotten fouled up. We would have, you know, we would have achieved this thing we meant to achieve. You know, this horrible financial loss wouldn't have happened. This other thing, you know, et cetera. So I'm not going to allow myself to feel, oh, boy, was that bad. Instead, I'm going to blame you and get into a rage at you, and that'll protect me from my own sorrow. So these are two things I think are very, very potent in blaming. And, you know, the title of the chapter is The More We Blame, The Further We Get From Ourselves. And I think that's the essential truth about blame, that in order not to deal with the things in ourselves that we find hard to deal with, we blame others, and we get away from those things.
Yeah, you mentioned how we can cry for the whales or the actress on the screen, but feel nothing for ourselves due to that unmourned loss. I think, don't you too, that it's a cultural thing that we don't do death and grief in this culture?
Yeah, I think there are other cultures that are better at it, where it's more understood that sorrow is okay, that it's part of life, that loss is a part of life, and that there are ways of dealing with loss, and that people come together around these kinds of cultural, you know, prescribed methods of mores and routines and rituals for dealing with the expectable losses of what that happened in a life.
We have a caller, Stephen Ellsworth. Come on, talk to us.
Yeah, I'd like to ask if our response to September 11th as a society shouldn't be more multifaceted than united we stand and we're all together in this. There should be elements of society that are concerned with justice, other elements that are concerned with forgiveness. And just as in raising a child, you know, there are certain behaviors that you don't tolerate, yet at the same time you are still able to treat them humanly and with forgiveness. And I wonder if this, this united approach is a bit of a myth.
Well, it scares me because as much as I think that in order to mobilize a country to fight, it is necessary to have an enemy, and that inevitably when you have an enemy, you have a kind of, a black and white view of the world, at least in that zone, and a black and white view of the world is never entirely fair. I do think that it's very possible to go way overboard with that. And when I see I think that what happens is in times of mobilization like this, those aspects of the culture, those people who are more inclined to be to have a black and white view of the world, and who are ready to view another nation as all bad or another ethnic group as all bad, these people who in times of peace might be a little bit ashamed of that tendency in themselves and would find it not tolerated, are able to ascend more rapidly into positions of power. You know, when they start pasting up their flags all over the lobby of your building and, trying to whip everybody into a patriotic fervor, it's not so easy to say, hey, you know, back off. This isn't exactly the healthiest way to respond. Because it looks like you're being unpatriotic and it puts you in a very indefensible position. So I agree with you. We need a multifaceted response. I'm kind of pleased, really, that we have as much of it as we seem to have right now, and I hope we can hold on to it.
Yeah, well, I agree. I think, you know, this is a generation that remembers Vietnam, and we realize that there are some things that we did there that were totally inhumane and unethical, and this is an opportunity for those of us remember that to implement that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I hope we can.
Okay, well, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks, Steve. Thank you for calling in. And again, listeners, the number to call in, 469-0500 or 866-625-9378. Again, we're speaking to Dr. Robert Caron, author of The Forgiving Self. Feel free to call in and talk to Dr. Caron, ask questions or make your opinions known. So continuing on with our little dialogue here, I'm thinking when you talk about people being afraid to speak their desires, I wonder if that same spark that leads to exhibiting or expressing desire is also the same kind of fire that fires up anger, and how can we be on better terms with that anger or that desire, that kind of fiery feeling in us when its energy threatens to overwhelm us?
Well, I think one of the most difficult things we all face is getting anger right. You said before that our culture was not one that was particularly conducive to helping people learn how to mourn. Well, I think the same thing can be said about helping people understand, helping children understand how to live with anger in a creative and productive way. We tend to think that anger is a bad thing. It doesn't mean we aren't explosive and murderous with our anger, you know, at times. But in our minds, in our view of it, we tend to think that anger is a bad thing. And so there's we're frightened of it. You know, we may have been, punished for having it as kids. We may have been subject to thunderbolts of terrifying anger from our parents. And anger scares us. Well, our own anger scares us because we're afraid of the damage that we can do. And other people, the anger of others scare us because of, you know, what it might do to us. And so we avoid it unnecessarily, and we never really become connoisseurs of it. We never learn how to enjoy it. And how to recognize, you know, when we're going into a bad zone with it. I think that the most difficult thing of all when it comes to anger is being able to hold on to two opposing views at the same time. On the one hand, you just stepped on my toe, and I want to wring your neck. I hate you. I want to kill you. On the other hand, some more significant betrayal. But on the other hand, I know that, you know, we've known each other for 17 years. You're someone I really value. That even though I feel like you're horribly insensitive and did something absolutely inexcusable, and it shows what a monster you really are, I also know that you're not a monster, and that we have a really warm and positive and strong connection. And that, there may be troubles, but I don't want to throw you away. I certainly don't want to murder you. So if you can hold on to those two views at the same time, you can have your anger and also protect the other person from your anger, so that you can find a way to express it in a way that, you know, lets the other person, you know, live and breathe and take it in without feeling threatened or put down or denounced or made guilty. You know, it's a talent that I think takes a lot of work to develop, but it is one that really can make a tremendous difference in all our relationships.
Okay, we have another caller, Nancy in Deer Isle.
Hi, Bella. Hi, Dr. Kern.
Hi.
This is such an interesting subject, and you just started touching on part of my question. Some people, when you raise the subject of forgiveness, are so negative, and that's an understatement. And you probably do remember the movie Dead Man Walking, in which one of the families of the victims was ready to and did forgive the person who murdered their child, and the other family just could not possibly begin to forgive. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit about the mechanics of introducing the subject of forgiveness, if you touch on that in your book at all.
Well, before you go on, what do you mean by the mechanics of introducing it?
Well, how do you broach that subject with somebody who's full of rage and could never possibly consider the idea of forgiving?
Do you have a specific example in mind?
Well, I hate to sound like the kind of person whose thinking is influenced by movies, but there was another movie that I remember seeing a few years ago with Carol Burnett, and her daughter was murdered, and she ended up by the end of the movie adopting the daughter of the person who had murdered her daughter.
Mm.
And at first this was just totally out of the question. But of course, the perpetrator of the crime was in prison, and I think that his daughter was being brought up by his ill and elderly mother who was dying.
By the way, my book is filled with stuff like this from movies.
I was just going to say, if I could interject, Nancy, you will love this book because it is full of many different films.
I'm going to get this book. I think it sounds wonderful. And now I'm going to hang up because I'm on a cell phone and I don't want to be disconnected, but I would like to hear your answer.
Okay.
And thank you so much. This is all very interesting.
Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Bye, Bella.
The answer to her question, I think, the most honest answer I could give is I don't know. If someone you know were to kill a child of mine, my response I really couldn't predict. I mean, the most fundamental and immediate response would be I'd want to kill the person who killed my son. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. I want to rip him to shreds, and I wouldn't care about the consequences. You could string me up afterwards, that's fine. But that's what I want to do. Now, if I could evolve to another place, what would cause me to do it? I'm not exactly sure. I do know a man who I spoke to at length, whose story was in the newspaper a number of years back, whose son was murdered by a young gang member. I mean, a kid who didn't even know his son. He was just, you know, said, okay, kill that guy, when he was delivering pizza. And he was a college student at the time. And this man, Azeem Kamisa, made it his goal in life not to succumb to hatred, bitterness, murderousness, revenge. He felt for his own health he could not go to that place. And he went on a tremendously powerful spiritual journey and very quickly started making positive moves. He set up a foundation to work against youth violence. He immediately made contact with the grandfather of the murderer, who was the boy's guardian, and got him. And they had a very simpatico connection. They liked each other. They connected. They worked together in this foundation. He began making speeches around the world, talking about, you know, when one child kills another, two lives are lost, and. He told me, look, every morning when I wake up, it's a struggle to find this place in me, what I would call the forgiving self. He being a religious Muslim, thinks of it in more religious terms. But I don't know how to help someone to move in that direction in a generic way. If I'm face-to-face with that person, or if I'm face-to-face with myself, I'd have to just see where the levers were, what the possibilities were. I think the example of Dead Man Walking is a very powerful one. I saw that film, too. And, you know, you meet this guy who's a murderer, and not only a murderer, but he's an unapologetic, scuzzy, arrogant, dismissive creep who you wouldn't want anything to do with. And yet, It's a sort of a miracle to see how the young woman who's a clergywoman who's working with him in jail comes to really get to know him and to love him and to help him to begin to love himself. And it's a transforming act, I think, for everybody in the audience to realize, my God, there is something lovable in this man. He is not strictly a monster. So I'm not sure that really answers the caller's question, but there's some thoughts on it.
Again, callers or listeners, you may become callers by calling 469-0500 or 866-625-9378. We've got about 10 minutes left of the program. Feel free to call and speak with Dr. Karen on the topic of forgiveness. Yes, you speak of the killer inside us. I love this term because we all surely have it. If we were to acknowledge, as you did, if someone were to harm one of my children, I couldn't be held accountable for my actions. And like you say, string me up, it's fine. You know, go ahead, because it would be a gut reaction kind of thing, although we certainly know that the loss of two lives is not going to solve the loss of the first. Can you comment a little bit about these murderous impulses, where you find that they come from, or is this appropriate to ask?
Oh, yeah, why not? I think murderous impulses are, you know, things that I think we're born with them. But I do think that, you know, it starts out that, you know, if we got a diaper pin sticking in us, well, I guess that's an outdated analogy because now we don't have pins on diapers anymore. But, you know, a baby who's in pain because something is sticking in him, making him uncomfortable, begins to feel like his mother is a monster. You know, he's crying, the world is awful, everything is hell, mommy is hell, I'm hell, everything stinks, because if mommy, well, I don't know, there's not, there's not this kind of logic. But the good, loving mommy is not there, you know? She's not there to do what she's supposed to do. Instead, the evil witch is there, or not there, causing this to happen. Because, you know, mommy is the goddess who rules the world. And so these murderous impulses are there from infancy. And what happens is, to the extent that we've had, you know, wounds inflicted on us by our parents, and, you know, we've all had them to one degree or another, we, and to the extent that they're not really worked through, they're unprocessed, unconscious, dissociated, cut off from, live in us in a way that we don't even know about. To the extent that they exist like that, we're going to have these murderous impulses towards anyone who manages to step into the line of fire by causing us to feel as if we are a small, powerless child and they are that bad parent we experience when we are little. And very often we go into exactly that state when we get hurt or betrayed by anyone who we really care about. So this murderous stuff that we feel is often not just a part of human nature, but also a very powerful remnant of an inner drama that we've never quite made conscious or worked ourselves out of.
Well, I'm going to take a little side trip here, although it's relevant to Nancy's comment on the actual murder of a child. You talked about this boy who witnessed his father's suicide, and your statement, extreme efforts are made at times to undo a child's reality, where people around him said, you didn't just see that. How many of us remember times when we had a certain perception that parents or other authority figures told us wasn't real? You know, even in fact, we saw something that someone said, you didn't just see. Can you just comment on this, speak to this?
Well, it's one of the ways in which parents really limit the emotional lives of their kids. In this particular case that I was talking about how parents really don't allow children to mourn. They're so afraid of their own pain, and that they can't bear to see their children's pain, and they don't know how to help them with it. And they think, by some kind of magical, primitive thinking, that if they just tell their kids, you saw your daddy hanging in the closet? You didn't see that. That was a television show. You got confused. Your daddy died of a heart attack. Your daddy's still alive. He just had to go away. We think that in some way that's protecting our kids, and it's really a horrible disservice to them. And it's also a horrible disservice to ourselves. It's part of this flight from mourning I was talking about. And I think kids are often, if it's not too strong a word, abused in this way, where they're not really listened to, they're not really understood, they're not really allowed to have the feelings they have. And when you're not allowed to have the feelings you have, that's the beginning of all kinds of negative psychological developments, shame, obsessiveness, regret, self-hatred, you know, a sense of being a victim, a tendency towards grudge states. This is all a part of that inner drama that develops from early childhood.
You say how often do we forgive mistreatment in order to avoid conflict or welcome the renewed warmth of someone who was just abusing us? Is this a forgiveness worth having?
Yeah, no way. You know, it's not forgiveness at all. You know, to be afraid and to surrender and to give ourselves away, you know, for a smile from someone who really is unwilling to own up to what he did, this is not a forgiveness worth giving or having. And it's a betrayal of the self. I think an awful lot of what passes for forgiveness is lip service, cowardice, complicity in our own abuse, a reliving of early dramas in which we have to get along in order to be loved. And by get along, I mean surrender our own sense of self. I think there's an awful lot of forgiveness that isn't worth the words it's spoken with.
So that leads to my next question, and probably final one, and if any final comments you want to make after this, please do. How do you perceive unconditional forgiveness? Is this healthy?
Well, it depends. You know, I think to a certain extent, parents have that kind of attitude towards the children they love. You know, that, you know, no matter what wrong the child does, my love is so strong that nothing could shake it. So it is a kind of unconditional forgiveness. You know, there's like a, total tolerance for the child being who he is. It doesn't mean that we don't get angry at him. It doesn't mean that we don't want to take this howling baby who we can't console and throw him against the wall at times. It doesn't mean that we don't want to discipline the child and teach him, you know, how not to get into bad habits of being. And that doesn't mean that we're not going to get, you know, really angry for being mistreated by the child and let him know it. But in some deeper place, that love and that sense of all-embracing forgiveness never really goes away. Now, whether we can have that for other people we love in our lives is a big challenge, because it's very rare that anyone ever achieves that kind of grace in our lives, that kind of total love. And for many people, their children never do. But I think it is a possibility. On the other hand, I don't like the idea of saintly forgiveness. You know, that that we should forgive everything that befalls us. That you know, Jesus or some other saint was able to do it, and therefore we should too. That's just not the human condition. That's not the way human psychology works. And one of the reasons I wrote the book and called it The Forgiving Self is that I wanted to convey the idea that forgiveness is a process, that the process has many, many stages and aspects to it, that for certain types of forgiveness, it can take a very long time, and that we can't hold ourselves accountable for not being like the one in a million human being whose forgiveness is instantaneous and pervasive.
Or the one who could forgive the murder of the child.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to thank you again, Robert Caron, PhD, author of The Forgiving Self, The Road from Resentment to Connection, the subject of our interview on Alternative Currents today. The book is published by Doubleday. I'd like to thank Helen York, my engineer, who I so often forget to thank, but who's just an invaluable resource to me. And we'll talk to you next month on Alternative Currents. This has been Bella Johnson, your host. Have a good month.
This hour of community radio is brought to you in part by Audiographics Multimedia, producing